Lecture 36, Medieval Political Traditions, Part 1.
Welcome once again to our series of lectures on the foundations of Western civilization. This will be lecture number 36, and in this lecture and the next one, we will explore several central themes in medieval European political development. This lecture will focus particularly on England and France, while the next one will look at Ireland, Iberia, Italy, Germany, at some other regions in Europe. Now, we've talked about the material conditions of life in high medieval Europe. We've talked about the social conditions of life. So now we will be asking questions about how these people organized themselves politically and institutionally. Now, in order to cover a lot of space and a lot of time, we're going to follow certain basic themes, four of them in particular. One of them, for example, will be the development or the failure to develop the territorial integrity of the state. Where did these political entities actually wind up on the map? A second theme that we'll follow is the elaboration or the failure to elaborate strong institutions of central government. Where did they emerge? Why did they emerge? Where did they not emerge? Why not? A third theme will be the expansion of governmental activity. Now, we can look at that in a couple of different ways. One thing that we'll notice, not so much in this lecture as in the next one, is that in the Celtic world and Scandinavian and the Slavic world, considerable areas that were not, as it were, on the map in the Carolingian period come on the map and, of course, remain on the map until today. So that's one way we can think about an expansion of government activity. Another way we can think about the expansion of government activity is to talk about the growing size, the growing complexity, the growing sophistication of governmental institutions within particular states. In other words, quite simply, government became more present for more people more of the time. Fourth and finally, though we'll say less about this subject than about the others, though it is an important subject, is the question of changes in the social composition of the governing classes. All right, let's begin with England. We left off with England some time ago when the small early Anglo-Saxon kingdoms were just about to have a rather long and rather unhappy encounter with the Vikings. We can pick up our story there and then take it through several conquests, through foreign entanglements, through dynastic instability, in other words, through a lot of very difficult challenges which the English faced, and yet we'll arrive at the end of the 13th century at a fairly well-organized and governed state. Now, it must be said, England is relatively small and considerably more homogeneous than many other European states. That made political development, coherent political development, something less of a challenge than elsewhere. It doesn't make it easy, and it didn't make it inevitable, but it made it somewhat easier. We'll have occasion to see when we talk, for instance, about France or about Germany, that complexity there was actually a considerable retarding factor in political development. Well, the little kingdoms of the so-called Heptarchy often produced one leading member, but never really produced a national monarchy. Now, as the kingdoms of the Heptarchy succeeded one after another, England then encountered the Vikings. First in 793 when they attacked Lindisfarne Island. We mentioned that in an earlier lecture. And then across most of the 9th century, there were sporadic attacks. Now here, now there. Quite unpredictable, damaging, but not decisive in their impact. In 865, the so-called Great Army, having been defeated in France, crossed the Channel, attacked England, and actually settled down to the business of conquering the country. In these difficult circumstances, England found a very effective ruler, a very effective king, in Alfred the Great, who reigned from 871 until 899. Alfred began in Wessex, in the southwest of the country, a rally that by his death had moved the Viking, mainly Danish, these Vikings that we're talking about are mainly Danes, it had moved their frontier right up to the Thames Valley. In other words, most of southern England had been liberated. Over the course of the 10th century, Alfred's successors continued to move the frontier farther and farther north into the Danelaw, the part of England that was under Scandinavian control that was centered on the city of Jorvik. We know that city as York today. It was Roman Eboracum. So actually York bears to this day a Viking name.